It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 91, The Breaking Point. The Breaking Point is a 1951 film directed by Michael Curtiz, starring John Garfield, Phyllis Thaxter, and Patricia Neal. It is a noir film. It's charitable to call it a remake of To Have and Have Not. It is an adaptation of the original book To Have and Have Not by Ernest Hemingway. We will get into all of those ins and outs shortly, but first let me introduce you to our panelists. First up, it's Randy Dutinga. Hi.
Hi. I got to just say that I love this movie. I mean, if this was a Bo Derek movie, it would be 10. It would not be Bolero. I can say that. But this is, I really rediscovered this movie watching it for this show. And I think it's one of my, I'm a big noir guy, and I'm putting it as one of my top noirs. It's just, everything about it is just fantastic.
On a scale of Bolero to 10, there you go. Also here, Nathan Alderman, hello.
Hi. Yeah, I agree with Randy. I'd never heard of this film. I was a little leery going in, but it completely won me over. It's such a well-made and interesting film, and I'm really looking forward to talking about it. Sorry, I got no jokes this week. This one's good.
No jokes. I'm so glad that both of you liked it. I get a sense from your answers what your response to my next question will be, which is whether you've seen it before. And Randy, had you seen this before at all? Were you somewhat familiar with it? What's your background?
Yes, I'd seen it before, but I don't. For some reason, it didn't strike me until this time how much of an excellent movie it is. Just everything, the performances, the writing, the production, the scene, the town is and the ocean are characters of the movie. And what really struck me is just how achingly vulnerable all of the main characters are. And even the femme fatale, we could talk about this. I was trying to think of other movies, other noirs, where they have really vulnerable women characters. And I was thinking like maybe Gene Hagen in The Asphalt Jungle. But it's rarely that you see a femme fatale who is so vulnerable as Patricia Neal. It's something really, really unique. That her, I feel like the main characters do, just like their chests are kind of torn open, and you can kind of like see their beating hearts, you know, their frailties, and that's something really, really extraordinary in a movie.
So Nathan, I'm guessing you haven't seen this before, but what was your trepidation about it? Why were you worried going in?
I don't know if I was worried. I just wasn't sure I'd like it. It sounded like, what, a guy's on a boat and it's an adaptation of Hemingway. I'm not the biggest Hemingway fan. I like his early short stories, but a lot of his later stuff, no thanks. But the social conscience of this movie really jumped out at me. The way it takes pains to portray minority characters as fully realized human beings, the degree of depth that Phyllis Thaxter's character gets. I had seen it before in the sense that I'd seen the last 5 minutes at the end of Key Largo, which apparently they completely ripped off from the original Hemingway story.
Yeah, I can't say that I'm a big Hemingway fan either. I guess it's fortunate that many of the adaptations of his work that have ended up on film don't really come off as recognizable bits of Hemingway. This, just to sort of get to the story of how this came to be, so Howard Hawks, who made the original To Have and Have Not in the 40s, was on a boat with Hemingway in 1939, and they talked about doing an adaptation of his book, To Have and Have Not, which Hawks did not like, and he called it one of the worst of Hemingway's writings. And whether that's true, I don't know, because I haven't read enough Hemingway.
Ooh, Howard. Howard, that's right. The old man in the sea hadn't come out at that point.
That's so. Right. There was...
Howard had no idea what kind of prophecy he was unleashing.
There you go. There you go. But I do not have an encyclopedic enough knowledge of Hemingway to rank them. But I was like, all right, if you say it's bad, then I'm probably not going to enjoy it, not being a super Hemingway fan in any case. So it eventually gets made at Warner Brothers To Have or Have Not in 1944 with Bogart and Bacall. It's their first movie. It is known primarily for the introduction of Lauren Bacall and how she and Bogart meet cute, have sparks, whatever you want to say. But there's nothing about it that's really to have and have not, other than the name of the main character, and that there's a boat. And somehow, I don't know whether it was, you know, weird production things that cause it to be so different. That happens in studio films often, where they say, okay, we're going to start with a story, we're just going to change one little thing, and by the end of it, it's a whole different movie. But that's neither here nor there. But so people at Warner Brothers and Jerry Wald and the writer of the movie felt that To Have and Have Not been made as a film. And this one, called The Breaking Point, does take liberties from To Have and Have Not, and I have not read the book, and if you have, please chime in about it, if not, we won't worry about it. But it is much more close to the novel than the original, which isn't what makes the movie good. The movie has its own quality, its own reasons for being good. I think, as Nathan says, there's a lot of social conscience, which comes, I think, to a great degree from John Garfield's involvement, and obviously from the Juan Hernandez character, just how wonderfully he gets to play a fully realized human being, which is, wow, it's 1950. What a concept. And yeah, I think all the leads are really great and well played and play the parts differently and somewhat better than in some other films, because I've seen bad movies with all of these three actors. So it's like, hey, you put lightning in a bottle, I guess. But yeah, I think when I first saw it several years ago, I don't remember exactly when, but it was once I had become a film noir fan, and it's like, oh, The Breaking Point, here's another film noir to see. And I remember being surprised by it too. It's a very little known film. It wasn't, I mean, you can see it on TCM. It has had a Criterion release. In fact, I read something today about how people were surprised that it had a Criterion release because it was not so well known. It was not a hit when it was made at the time. Those two things are mutually exclusive often. But it does feel like it's an underappreciated film.
It's understood that was because that John Garfield was getting tied up in the whole HUAC investigation, the House Un-American Activities Commission, and that the studio didn't want to promote him or the movie. And as I was reading it, just kind of died off at the box office and wasn't a thing because it just wasn't well promoted.
Yeah, I think the studio was behind it when they made the movie and when it came out. But very soon after that, Garfield's name started becoming mentioned in the whole HUAC conversation. And so, yeah, the studio was backing away from that stuff as fast as they could.
And I'll give you a little spoiler alert. Later on, I'm going to talk about the connection between John Garfield and the old SNL line, Generalissimo Francisco Franco is still dead. There's a John Garfield link there.
I haven't read the original book, but I did look it up on Wikipedia because I was curious, and it sounds like this is a pretty faithful adaptation, other than transplanting the location from Florida and Cuba to California and Mexico. It seems like this plays it pretty close to the vest, and a lot of the economic themes that were in Hemingway's book are here too, which really interested me. And this was my first John Garfield movie. I'd heard about him. I'd listened to podcasts about his role in the HUAC hearings, but he's remarkable here, especially since he is 37 years old and 2 years away from his death. He seems a lot older than that. He also seems like if every early Warner Brothers film somehow coalesced and took human form.
So John Garfield had been a star at Warner Brothers since 1939. He had been part of the Actors Studio in the 30s in New York. And even back then, the Actors Studio had some political connections that didn't always stand it in good stead. But he had been sort of the first angry young man or sort of hot-blooded kind of actor. I mean, he's not a method actor in the way that a Brando or a Dean might have been, but he was definitely a different sort of charismatic actor than the matinee idol types of the previous generations. And he had played gangsters and he played sensitive guys and stuff up through those 10 years and leading men and, you know, all sorts of... He's had some interesting roles, some movies of his that I really like and some that are sort of meh. But yeah, I noticed on this viewing that he does seem to have grown older. Whether he's beyond 37 or not, I don't know. But he's definitely not the same sort of young hothead guy that he was in the early 40s, and he's wearing the wisdom of his years in his character. And he had a heart defect, which is why he died at 39 of a heart attack. But also there, it's believed that the struggles that he was having with the HUAC hearings and just politics in general and the studio not supporting him probably played a role in his not surviving.
Wait, you're telling me Jack Warner stabbed somebody in the back? No way.
He also lost a child, I think, a few years before this movie. I think it was a six-year-old girl who died in an accident, from what I was reading.
Yes.
And also, he was he had a lot of affairs. I think mistresses. I think when he was married, and he had a couple other kids. I think at least one kid is still around. But yeah, so I think he had a
For
lot
now,
of.
We've jinxed it.
don't kill off Julie Garfield. Come on. He had lost his child in 1945, and apparently that did sort of precipitate some of either his acting out or perhaps some of his decline. He had been married to the same woman for quite some time, but that, as Ed says, it sometimes will do, did not help his marriage very much. And yeah, he had two kids, one of whom has, you know, spoken about her dad and introduced films of his and that sort of thing. So, you know, she's another one of those kids who she hasn't like dined out on his career entirely, but she's been around to sort of say, hey, here, this is what John Garfield is like as I remember him, that sort of thing.
And he was in several top noirs. He was in The Postman Always Rings Twice, Humoresque, and his last movie was He Ran All the Way, which is a more obscure noir. But he really was a star in that genre.
He's a lot like James Cagney in that he's got this wonderful blend of charisma, toughness, and vulnerability that really rivets your attention. He's so broken down in this movie and so struggling, and you feel that desperation and that pain that he's carrying all through his performance. It's really quite something.
Yeah, they actually thought about James Cagney for this role and also Kirk Douglas, and somehow Errol Flynn. Don't know how that happened.
Normally, I'm a fan of casting Kirk Douglas in anything, but I cannot see him in this role. Garfield is just, I can't even see Cagney in this role.
Well,
Garfield's just perfect for it.
Cagney was at the point in his career where he was getting leading man roles he really shouldn't have been getting because he was too old, and I, you know, far be it from me to be the one to say, I'm sorry, you're done, you're too old. Especially, I wouldn't say that with women who get shafted in that way. But I feel like with as many people, you know, perhaps needing those opportunities and perhaps being better suited to the roles, I think I would say, okay, Cagney, your time as a leading man who's juggling two women and perhaps trying to make ends meet, that it might be that's not the role for you in 1950. So we also have Phyllis Thaxter and Patricia Neal, both interesting actors. Phyllis Thaxter is somebody who had been around playing roles something like this in MGM movies since the early 40s. She you know, would be the woman in the movie that was headlined by a man, and sometimes she was a supportive wife. In fact, that was quite often her role. I think this role really gives her an opportunity to have some depth, not only because of her performance, but I just feel like she's well-written. She's given a lot of things to do, even though, you know, there is a good part of long-sufferingness. You know, Harry, her husband, comes home, and he's obviously got some stuff going on. He doesn't want to talk to her about it, or can't talk to her about it. And she is trying to get him to stop being a boat captain and maybe be on her father's lettuce farm as a foreman, which is not something that Harry feels like is a good thing for him. But this is a really good part for her. I feel like it's by far her most interesting performance.
And she has this kind of physical connection with John Garfield that you can tell she's deeply in love with him, but physically attracted to him. And she has this one line where she says, I can think about you anytime and get excited. And that seems such a a forward-looking line so explicit and so intimate. It made me think about in The Great Gatsby when Daisy Buchanan is looking at Jay Gatsby and says, "You're so cool. You always look so cool." And it just reveals the lust that she has for Gatsby. And I felt like that was this line. I can think about you anytime and get excited. Just seemed very, very, just so unlike any very many movies of of 1950.
Well, especially amongst people who are already married couple, right?
Yeah,
when there's somebody else in the marriage, or will be at later in the movie, you know.
And she's not this. It's a portrait of a marriage, and even that they have that what they're like stealing a kiss, and the kids are getting kind of grossed out. But it just shows. And she's not portrayed as a especially beautiful or captivating woman. She's kind of portrayed as kind of attractive, but not a knockout. So it gives somebody who's not has movie star looks a chance to show a full character.
Yeah, you definitely understand why a couple this young has two children who are fairly well grown already. There's a heat between them that, like y'all said, you don't see in married couples in the 50s. Housewives in the 50s are supposed to be happy, brainless baby factories, but not ever sexy. They're not supposed to show that kind of interest in their husbands, and that quality between them makes their relationship so interesting and makes it really disappointing when John Garfield kisses Patricia Neal, because up till then I was really, really enjoying the way she was coming on to him 15 Ways to Sunday, and he was just like, "Nope, sorry, I'm married." But I love the scene that she and Patricia Neal have together, where like they kind of have a grudging respect for one another. And Patricia Neal, you know, is not she's not going to try to do Phyllis Thaxter any dirtier than she has to. And I love that Phyllis Thaxter takes that shot glass and just downs it in the middle of the day. It's very rare. I think Gun Crazy is the only other film from the 50s I've seen that's like, you know, women in the 50s are kind of going through it. And this film definitely is like, yeah, it's not a picnic being a 1950s housewife under economic constraints.
Well, Shelley, I have to tell you, Shelley, that if you ever start paying more attention to Nathan than me, I'm going to dye my hair blonde. I'm just going to tell you this right now.
Well, I don't know. That might be a good thing. I might enjoy that.
That is, I never thought I'd be compared to Patricia Neal in any context. Speaking of which, we last saw her on The Fountainhead, and she is so much better here. She's great.
She has this interesting career. I like her. Even in The Fountainhead, I like her. She's the one thing about that movie I like, I have to confess. And because I really enjoy her sort of slinking and slithering in that movie. She's actually more of a predator in The Fountainhead. In this movie, I mean, she likes Harry, and she knows he's married, and, you know, she goes for it. And John Garfield eventually kisses her, and that's the point at which, like, wait, I'm not in on this. But I like her performance because, as you say, she's got some vulnerability. She's got, I mean, you know, we meet her when she's with this guy who is eventually going to stiff John Garfield on the fishing trip that he's chartered, and he abandons her. And so whatever their relationship is, whether she's been, going with guys for financial remuneration or just because that's the thing you do, she's going through it herself, and she's sort of trying to find a way to get through. When we finally see where she lives, I mean, she's apparently got some money over time because she lives in a nice style, which it sort of seems weird that apartment is right there in the town where the fishing boats are. I don't really understand the sort of geography of socioeconomic class that we have here. But we are meant to understand that she has, saved up some money in her life, but probably is still having relationships with men that have some financial advantage for her, whatever the deal is there.
I kind of like that it felt like her character was interested in John Garfield because he was the kind of guy who wouldn't be interested in her. I think you can see that, like, she kind of lights up at that challenge, but also out of respect for the fact that he's basically a decent guy. And I did enjoy that after he kisses her, he's like, yeah, no, this isn't working. I'm not this guy. And she respects that.
But I think she's also kind of upset that she can't land him, that she feels in some way, I get the sense that she feels in some way like she's a failure. And that's part of her vulnerability is what she feels when she doesn't get what she wants. And she blames her. I think in some way seems like she blames herself.
Well, she goes after him in the first place as sort of a conquest thing. Like even before her boyfriend, her erstwhile older boyfriend leaves her, she's making a play for John Garfield. And he says no very firmly and I think at that point, it would be rational for her to conclude that, no, I'm not going to get with you while your boyfriend's on the boat. And then when that guy is gone, she continues. And John Garfield is still like, no, uh-uh. And what he says is not, I'm not interested in you. You're unattractive. He says, look, he basically says, I've got it bad for my wife. And she understands that. She says, oh, I forget exactly what it was, something like one of those or something like that. So she recognizes a man who is trying specifically to be faithful to his wife and who does so because he genuinely loves and respects this woman. And Patricia Neal's like, oh, that means I'm not going to be able to succeed. And she does keep trying and she does eventually get him to kiss her. But yeah, it becomes apparent that he's not the kind of guy that she's used to being around, probably, and that's interesting to her.
I love all the great lines in this. There's so many great lines in the movie, like when she says, usually when a guy tells me that he loves his wife, there's a but right after that.
Yeah, she is so cool. She's just got a quip for every occasion. She's got that tough exterior with that vulnerability behind it. You don't think of femme fatales as cool. They can be intriguing. They can be mysterious. They can be sexy. But she's like kind of awesome. You kind of want to be her as much as you want, even more than you want to be John Garfield, because he's kind of just like struggling along. She knows what she's doing.
Yeah, Eddie, the Czar of Noir, Eddie Muller, on TCM, he talked about this movie when he presented it on Noir Alley, and he said that she may be the most believable femme fatale in noir, because she's so kind of multifaceted and not just this walking sex. there's a lot to her.
And I guess it helps that she clearly isn't after Harry for his money, and she clearly isn't trying to ruin his marriage. You know, she genuinely, she wants him. I won't say whether she loves him or likes him or whatever, but she wants him. She has lust for him. And it's an interesting thing to sort of process her motivations about Garfield versus, you know, the guy that we met her at the beginning of the movie with. And she talks later about somebody else. She had sort of tossed offline. There's later in the movie, she says something about her fiance. I'm like, wait, what? Where did this person come from? And so I don't know. Presumably she's continuing to have relationships with men. And, you know, Harry is probably on a different plane than those other men in terms of what she would like to get from that relationship.
I also love how much of a character the town is. The film benefits so much from shooting in real locations. It gives it this washed out air of seediness and desperation. I love sunlit noirs, and this is very much a sunlit noir. And I just love like the carnival, the racetrack, the betting parlors. It all makes it feel very convincing, like a community. Even those little working class houses on the canal by the water are all really interesting and evocative, and they're not something that you see over and over again in the movies.
Kind of reminds me more of Steinbeck than Hemingway, because there were movies of Steinbeck books that are set in Northern California, like up toward Monterey, where there are fishing villages. And then those were some in the late 30s and 40s. And they would set those films in towns that looked something like this, although because it's a little later and because they've got a budget, they actually managed to give us more things to look at. Like, I remember thinking, you know, so there's the bar where John Garfield goes and gets drunk, where clearly he's a regular and he's got credit, and basically the bartender gives him a bottle, and that's where Patricia Neal and Phyllis Thaxter finally meet. And so that's like his hangout, and it's kind of it doesn't look like a seedy place, but it looks like a neighborhood kind of divey place. And then the next time we see John Garfield at a bar, it's at this place overlooking the water, and I was like, oh, he's moving up in the world. Why is he at this bar? And so it does, the town does appear to have this washed out air, but different parts of the town have different kind of atmospherics and different socioeconomic castes. And there's a lot going on in that little town. It feels like everything is very close together, though, somehow, because there's not a lot of driving down the road and going 3 or 4 miles. I mean, John Garfield gets off his boat and he walks to his house.
They do have funny moments, like with the busybody neighbor. I like the kids, when Phyllis Thaxter
kids are
turns
great.
Blonde, the kids are like, oh my goodness, you know, what was that line that one of the kids had about it was something like, what are the neighbors going to think? Something like that.
Yeah, they're scandalized. Those kids are so funny. They are so true to life. They feel like real kids. They reminded me of not Vita, but Mildred Pierce's other daughter, the tomboy who dies too early in Mildred Pierce. Just
another Michael Curtiz movie.
Also written by the same screenwriter, as it happens, whose name I can't remember right at the moment.
But I
also think they work as sisters, because one is older and one is younger, and they have the sort of bickering that sisters might have, but they're also in it together sometimes. And so sometimes you have them kind of playing off against each other, and sometimes you have them, let's go run off to the movies together, which I think is very, very realistic of sisters. And partially because of their small roles, but they don't have the kids overact or be ridiculously cute. You know, they're just, they're kids.
And the younger girl is still
Carrie
alive.
Jackson.
She, yes, and she apparently was kind of a va-va-voom hot pot. Was that the word? Is that the phrase? She was an attractive young actress in the 60s and 70s.
The name is familiar, but I couldn't find anything in IMDb I knew her from. But I was like, I know that name. That somehow she's familiar. And she's talked about the movie, I think, in the past. Let's talk about Juano Hernandez and his son. So Juano Hernandez is a Puerto Rican actor who often plays black characters. And he had been in a movie before this called Intruder in the Dust, for which he was given a lot of praise. He made something like 25. He'd made films as far back as the 30s, but didn't make quote-unquote mainstream films, by which I mean films white audiences would see until the mid-40s. And he had a film and television career, but he made something like 28 films. But the ones that I've seen him in are very memorable. So first of all, he's a great actor. I really enjoy watching him. Very natural actor. The writing and the way his character is allowed to just exist as a human being, instead of how are we going to mistreat the black person today, which apparently in the Hemingway book, that character exists, and Harry uses the N-word to speak to and about him on many occasions in the book. So I'm glad that whether it's John Garfield's social conscience or whether it's just, hello, it's 1950, let's not be jerks, for whatever reason, that character and the actor are given a lot of respect. Clearly, he and John Garfield's characters are longtime friends. And there are several instances in the movie where they're protective of each other. And they get, and they don't, and it's very, very doodly in the sense that it's not like, hey, man, I got your back, I'm going to protect you. But they each do things that are clearly intended to look out for the other guy. And so it's such a good friendship. And Hernandez is such a good actor.
And it's also interesting that the kids, the two white girls and the Juano Hernandez's son, which actually was his son of the actor, that they hang out together, and there's no, there's no sign of tension, or it is like refreshing that like you said, that there's no sign of segregation or of racial overtones or undertones. These guys are just loyal friends to each other and trying to look out for each other.
Yeah, but if you watch closely, they surely had to, I'm guessing they had to do this so that this movie would be allowed to screen in the South, but the Juan O'Hernandez's son never directly interacts with either of John Garfield's characters' kids. They don't talk to each other. You know, the dad says go and play, but the kids never interact. And Juan O'Hernandez, and this is to take nothing away from the quality of his performance, how great it is that this film treats him and treats the Chinese characters as full human beings. But he's still in like a subservient role to John Garfield. You know, he's still carrying bags and taking orders, but at least here he gets to do it with, you know, I won't even say with dignity. That's kind of insulting and trite, but he gets to be a person, and you get to see the gentleness of their mutual friendship. He's someone that John Garfield can clearly rely upon in a fight or to have his back. And he's just a kind person without any trace of being servile about him, which I just really, really enjoyed, like seeing a Chinese American guy as like a suave, sophisticated, well-dressed gangster. I enjoyed the politics of this film immensely.
Yeah, I think Hernandez, it's interesting because the one thing, I guess if I were going to add something to what Juan Hernandez and John Garfield get to do together, I guess I would like Hernandez to have been more of a confidant for him, because, you know, Garfield doesn't confide in anybody. He's keeping all of this inside, which is why it's all so difficult for him. And, you know, when it all blows apart. But I guess it would kind of been interesting if there had been a scene where they're sort of, hey, what should we do about this? This is rough sledding that we're going through. Hey, I really need, how am I going to get out of this situation? And whether Hernandez could help him solve the problem or not, at least he'd have somebody to talk to. And I will say that, yes, he's working for John Garfield, but at the same time, it seems to be at a time of his choosing. Like, there's a point when Garfield's working on the boat and Juan Hernandez just sort of comes up and says, hey, man, what's going on? Let's do the thing, or I'll help you. It's not like, oh, you show up at 9 o'clock and you work for me. I mean, obviously they go out on trips together, and he probably does have a subservient role and probably is paid by John Garfield as an employee, but I get the sense that the relationship is as close to partners as it could be, you know, and not saying
it. I think at one point he says that, like, the boat is both of theirs or something.
I don't remember that, but you may be right. And it's possible, too, that not making that explicit would have been a way to sort of keep the bad guys off their backs.
And his son is really striking. In the film, they talk about how, you know, when you're alone, you've got nobody, you know, you're nothing. Watch who ends up alone at the end of the film. Yeah. It's Juan O'Hernandez's son. Everybody like gathers around John Garfield and then leaves. And this poor kid is standing on the dock, confused and lonely, and waiting for this dad who's never going to come home. And the movie wants to make sure you know
yes.
it. It lingers on that kid. He's the final image in the film. And without saying it explicitly, they want you to think about what this kid's life is going to be like now that his dad is gone and he has no one.
Because they've just shown you the two girls crying with their mother and the mother saying it's going to be okay. And she's just convinced Garfield to let them take off his arm and he may or may not survive. But he's definitely had his family and friends around him. And yes, as you say, he's being cared for after this terrible thing has happened. But Juan O'Hernandez's son is all by himself on that dock after all the people have gone away, and nobody looks back. Nobody thinks to say, hey, son, you know, what's and you're right. That's very intentional. That's part of the politics of the movie. The other politics of the movie that I just really enjoy is that whatever Harry does, he's doing it from a moral center. I mean, everything from the way he deals with the Chinese migrants that he's helping to smuggle. I mean, the guy who's the gangster is basically saying you can drown them if you want. And it probably is unlikely that somebody who wasn't a hardened criminal would feel like they wanted to drown eight people. But at the same time, Garfield gives them money when he lets them off the boat, and much to his own detriment. So he's not made any money on this thing that's gone wrong. And there are other instances in which his character, you know, and he hands money to people when he barely has any money of his own. And when he just takes a moral stand without, or does a moral thing without making a moral stand out of it, which I just think is so interesting and totally keeps you on the side of the character, even when he's, you know, doing things that are, you know, not great things to do.
There are movies where you think, wait, what about money? These characters always seem to have exactly as much money as they need for everything. This is not one of those movies. You sweat every dollar that he spends. You feel that crushing weight coming down on him. And I love the message that you can work in. This is a society where you can work really hard and it doesn't matter. If you just have bad luck, you're going to get crushed. And it's because of the way this society is set up. And maybe something needs to be done about that.
And it's also, he is a World War II veteran, and it kind of hints at the difficult life that he's come back to. And there is one line where Phyllis Thaxter says, "No, don't give me that Purple Heart BS," essentially. And I wanted to kind of understand more what she meant by that. And if she was trying to say, you know, don't whine about, you know, all that you've seen, all that you've been through, you know, focus on what's happening right now.
I think she says that from frustration. I thought about that line too, because he's a decorated veteran and he himself says, okay, I've had this experience. I've, you know, done a lot of stuff in the war and I got a lot of medals for it and I came home and that didn't make it easier to be a fishing boat captain. And she's frustrated because she wants her family to have more and she wants him not to break his back doing a job that is not giving him financial success or presumably happiness. And his point of view is, it's all I can do. I can't be a lettuce farmer. And so I don't really understand the Purple Heart line exactly. I don't feel like she's literally saying, don't tell me, you know, how you were wounded in the war or whatever. It seems to be some other kind of shorthand that is basically like, or maybe it is just I've heard about the difference between your experience in the war and the kind of life you're having now. And one way to fix it would be if you'd accept my dad's offer and be a lettuce farmer, which is what she wants for him. But seems like if he actually did it, she'd probably figure out pretty quickly that he was miserable and wouldn't want him to do it.
I wouldn't go to Salinas either.
But also, it's pretty amazing that she is shown taking in work, like working all night long after a full day of work, after taking care of her kids. And this is shown as heroic. It's not, you know, shown as emasculating or bad. The movie's like, she needs to do this. This is really important. And this is a huge sacrifice she's making for her family.
He doesn't like it. But I think some of that is about, I did get the sense that it was about emasculation for him to some extent, but also just how much time she's putting in. Like, and, you know, it wakes him up because she's on her sewing machine out there in the other room while he's trying to sleep. But I think whether it's strictly about him feeling emasculated or whether it's just, oh, if I were more successful, you know, you wouldn't have to do this and you could spend more time rearing our children, which is the agreement that we have. That would be better.
Yeah, I think he feels emasculated. I don't think the movie is saying that he should feel emasculated.
Right, that makes sense.
His pride is definitely his downfall in this film.
Yeah. Right, because he holds so much inside. That's the thing that, you know, you're talking about how he seemed older than his years. To me, it seems like he's got so much inside of him that he can't talk to anybody about, whether it's his wife or whether it's his partner or whether it's even Patricia Neal. Is there anybody in the world that he would let help him carry his burden or even just give him some informal guidance or counseling or friendship? But the answer seems to be no.
And that might be part of the politics of the film, too. Maybe, you know, the film is trying to argue that it's because he keeps everything to himself, puts everything on his own shoulders, that he ends up the way he does. Maybe if he'd reached out, if he'd, like, tried to get community help, maybe if he lived in a society where people doing favors for each other wasn't a matter of sleazy crooks trying to set somebody up to take the fall, then maybe things would have turned out better for him.
Possibly. That seems reasonable because it does feel like whatever choices he makes, there's no real way they can come out good. And so it's not a matter of, well, if you do something slightly differently, you have the opportunity to live the American dream or be successful. That's the point that the movie is making. He says, you know, one guy alone is doomed to not have success because he's at the mercy of bad guys or bad luck or just the inability to derive the amount of income you need from what you have, which is a boat that needs gas and groceries.
Yeah, this is just such a powerful and thoughtful film. And I kind of want to see To Have and Have Not now, because it sounds like that inverts this film's morality. There, the risk that Humphrey Bogart's character is taking is that he's smuggling for the French resistance against the Vichy and the Nazis. And that's a whole different movie right there. It's much more interesting to me to see a guy who is honest being forced to stick his neck out for criminals because he's got no other choice.
Yeah, they really leaned heavily, because Have and Have Not is 1944. They really leaned heavily on the World War II sort of adventure aspects of it, because I've seen it. And the thing about Have and Have Not that is memorable is the wrong word, but the things that actually makes it an interesting movie to watch is the experience of him trying to hustle that boat across the ocean. And is he going to get shot, or are the people he's smuggling the people he thinks they are, or are they bad guys? It's a straight up adventure tale, and it doesn't really address, except to the extent that, is Bogart a moral character or is he a mercenary or whatever. I guess it addresses that a little bit, but it really doesn't have nearly the pathos or the certainly not the politics, but it doesn't really have the doesn't have the ability to delve into the depth of the character to the degree that this movie does.
Yeah, but I learned how to whistle. You just, put your lips together and blow. So,
well, that's good. You have a future of impersonating Lauren Bacall or something like that.
I was going to say, doesn't that only work if you're Lauren Bacall?
Right,
for the rest of us, there's a few other stuff.
Well, if you're going to dye your hair blonde anyway, you might as well.
Oh, that's right. I play Nathan.
Oh, okay. You play the alderman.
So, It really is wild, though, how beat for beat the ending to this movie, which apparently comes straight from the book, is ripped off for Key Largo. I'd seen Key Largo last year, a lot of uncomfortable parallels in the story of a fascist gangster holed up in a hotel in Florida plotting to claw his way back to nation-running power.
Whatever do you mean.
Yeah, fun. but it really is remarkable, and it kind of took a little of the wind out of the sails here to see that exact same sequence of events play out almost, I think, even on the same set of the boat. I think it's the same boat from both movies.
Wow, I don't know that bit of trivia. That would be... Wow, that would be something to find out if that were the case.
I'm thinking, the setup of the boat is exactly the same as it is in Key Largo.
Certainly the events are very similar. You have one guy who has just enough bullets and who kills a lot of people in a very short order. I hadn't really thought of the parallels, and I should have, because, we saw Key Largo not long ago for the show, and I hadn't really processed the parallel quite that way. But, yeah, absolutely.
I love the racetrack heist. The Killing by Stanley Kubrick, and I love a good racetrack heist. And it's such a great, weird little interlude in this movie that mostly takes place on the sea, to have this extremely landlocked action sequence and that long, long hallway and the guy who's clearly not going to make it out with the rest of the gangsters. Just the great sense of tension and doom in that whole sequence.
Oh, we haven't talked about Wallace Ford.
Okay, let's talk about Wallace
Ford. What a delight. I mean, what a creep. Oh, God, he's just so perfect in that role. I mean, he oozes kind of that used car salesman sleaziness.
And yet you still feel sorry for him.
Well, when he gets shot, you do, but, and he really, he has this sort of tick where he always wants you to feel like he's, befriending you. I like you. I'm your friend. And if I'm John Garfield, I'm like, just stop saying that, okay? We're doing business together, but please stop saying it. But that seems to be important to Wallace Ford, that's like that's a tick of his, and it makes it even more creepy.
And I really like Victor Senyang as Mr. Singh. I know he's a bad guy, but at least he's a really cool bad guy. He's sharp, he's handsome, he's cunning and smart, and he gets outsmarted by John Garfield, but that's just because John Garfield knows he's going to try to double cross him. It was wonderful to see a completely non-stereotypical Chinese-American character in a movie from 1950.
Very good, small part, but he's very good. I mean, it's not a throwaway. It's not a caricature. I enjoyed that.
And I thought this must have been a very difficult movie to film with all the water scenes in the tight boat and then giving it that film noir gloss on top of everything else. It must have been quite a challenge.
It's that Warner Brothers budget, you know. I mean, they're sort of at the tail end of the real 40s Warner Brothers era, and we're getting the studios being divested of their film theaters at this point. But still, there's a little money for Warner Brothers to throw out their movies, and they have one of their most prolific directors. You know, Curtiz is so interesting because he's a lot of times thought of as this journeyman director, and he made a lot of mediocre Warner pot boilers, but he also made, you know, Mildred Pierce and Casablanca and a lot of pretty well-regarded films. And I actually read a biography of him fairly recently, and Garfield really wanted to work with him. He had worked with Garfield in his very early star-making turns. And Garfield was, as we said, at this point, sort of having a decline, some of which was politically motivated and some of which I think was probably this sort of decline in movie stars generally in the late 40s. And he thought that working with Curtiz again might sort of help give his career a little bit of a pick-me-up, or at least, you know, make him comfortable in the filmmaking process. It wasn't a hit movie, but I think it turned out to be a good one.
And I love the cinematography here. It's got wonderful chiaroscuro quality, especially when he ventures into some of the seedier bars. There's a texture and a palpableness to the images on screen that I really like. And the cinematography is by Ted McCord, who would also do East of Eden and The Sound of Music, bizarrely enough.
Interesting. That is, I love that when I see a director or a cinematographer, some technician behind the scenes who has done such wildly different films, because actors sort of be, oh, he's a Western actor, or he's a noir actor, and maybe he does a different thing occasionally. But, you know, directors and cinematographers and presumably lighting and costume designers and all those sorts of people can have these wild swings of their career to different genres and styles of film. And that's just interesting to talk about.
And I'll use this point to talk about the Saturday Night Live joke, where they, in the early years of SNL, they would do this joke about Generalissimo Francisco Franco is still dead. And that was a takeoff on a possibly apocryphal story about John Garfield. He was a heartthrob in his time, and when he died, he reportedly was at his mistress's house, and possibly in flagrante when he died of a heart attack. And there's a story that the newspapers kept running story after story about, you know, everything about him. How was his dog doing? How was his wife doing? Et cetera, et cetera. And finally, there's like some rookie editor at a newspaper in New York says, well, how about a headline that says John Garfield is still dead? And that became a joke that ended up inspiring the SNL thing about Generalissimo Francisco Franco is still dead.
Also, I think Franco went before he died. There were a lot of rumors about whether he died or something like that. I remember that. I think Chevy Chase used to do that on Weekend Update. And I think there was a period of time when it was like, wait, is he alive or isn't he? Because he was an old dictator in a reclusive state, I think.
Anyway. Yeah, I think it might have been like that, you know, that they where some celebrity is like near death and you get like daily updates. We're getting closer. I mean, right. He's not doing very well. You know, blah, blah.
Well, any final thoughts about The Breaking Point?
It's an unassuming movie, but it's really good. I was surprised at how, like I said, at how much I enjoyed it, especially how class conscious it is and how politically charged it is, and how that never gets in the way of the film being an effective piece of characterization and just a really compelling story about people.
And I think I'm going to really enjoy being a blonde.
I will point out, as I mentioned before, that there is a Criterion release. It's also has been available for free on YouTube. So sort of swings to whatever extreme you would like. You can find this movie for free or in fancy packaging as you like. And there will be links, as usual, in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with this show, please feel free to send us an email at lts@theincomparable.com. Find us on the socials at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. We will be back next week with An American in Paris. Bye now.
And the weird thing is, I'm not even a natural blonde.
The Incomparable Podcast Network. Become a member and support this show today. TheIncomparable.com/members.